original reading, "Be gone and take thy filth with thee." End of note. Long did I foster thy son, and forgave him the evil of his deeds, and afterward thy wife I succored, giving way against my counsel to her wild desires. Melko it is that hates thee, and not I. Yet what is it to me, and wherefore dost thou of the uncouth race of men endure to upbraid a king of the Eldalie? Lo, in Palisor my life began, years uncounted before the first of men awoke. Get thee gone, O Urin, from Melko hath bewitched thee, and take thy riches with thee. But he forbore to slay or to bind Urin in spells, remembering his ancient valiance in the Eldar's court. Then Urin departed, but would not touch the gold, and stricken in years he reached his Hisiloma and died among men. But his words living after him bred estrangement between elves and men. Yet it is said that when he was dead, his shade fared into the woods seeking Mavrin, and long those twain haunted the woods about the fall of Silver Bowl, bewailing their children. But the elves of Kor have told, and they know, that at last Urin and Mavrin fared to Mandos, and the Anori was not there, nor Turin their son. Turambar indeed had followed Nianori along the black pathways to the doors of Fui, but Fui would not open to them, neither would Vefontur. Yet now the prayers of Urin and Mavwin came even to Manwë, and the gods had mercy on their unhappy fate, so that those twain, Turin and Nianori, entered into Fos Almir, the bath of flame, even as Urwendi and her maidens had done in ages past before the first rising of the sun. And so were all their sorrows and stains washed away, and they dwelt as shining Valar among the blessed ones. And now the love of that brother and sister is very fair. But Turambar indeed shall stand beside Fionnwë in the great rack, and Melko and his drakes shall curse the sword of Mormaqin. And so saying, Eltas made an end, and none asked further. Changes made to names in The Tale of Turambar. Fuathlug replaced Fothlug, which replaced Fothlog. Nianori. At the first occurrence, page 71, my father originally wrote Nianori, N-Y-E-N-O, grave accent, R-E, Nianor in brackets. Afterwards he struck out Nianore, removed the brackets round Nianor, and added I, giving Nianori. At subsequent occurrences, the name was written both Nianor and Nianori, but Nianor was changed to Nianore later throughout the earlier part of the tale. Towards the end, and in the text written on slips that concludes it, the form is Nianor. I have given Nianori throughout. Tinwelland replaced Tinthelon, page 72, twice. See page 69 and note 3. Tinwelant replaced Tinthelon also in the concluding portion of the text. See note 32. Tinwelant replaced Tintoglen throughout the tale, except as just noted, where Tinwelant replaced Tinthelon in passages added later. See page 69. Gwetheling replaced Gwendoling at all occurrences. Gwendoling unchanged at page 76, but this is obviously an oversight. I read Gwetheling in the text. In the Gnomish dictionary, the form Gwendoling was changed to Gwetheling, see page 50. Flinding Bo-Thuillin replaced Flinding Go-Thuillin. This change made at the occurrence on page 78 was not made at page 82, but this was clearly because the form was missed, and I read Bo-Thuillin in both cases. The same change from Go to Bo in the tale of Tinuviel, see page 51. The form Thuillin is taken by the name when the patronymic is prefixed. Compare Duillin, page 79. Rodothlim replaced Rothwarin at every occurrence. Gurtholfin replaced Gorthalfin at the first occurrences, but from page 90, Gurtholfin was the form first written. Commentary on the Tale of Turambar, Section 1, The Primary Narrative. In commenting on this long tale, it is convenient to break it into short sections. In the course of this commentary, I frequently refer to the long, though incomplete, prose narrative, the Narn Hinhurin, given in Unfinished Tales, pages 57 and following, often in preference to the briefer account in the Silmarillion, chapter 21, and in reference to the former, I cite Narn and the page number in Unfinished Tales. 1. The Capture of Urin and Turin's Childhood in Hisalome, pages 70 to 72. At the outset of the tale, it would be interesting to know more of the teller, Eltas. He is a puzzling figure. He seems to be a man, he says, that our people called Turambar Turumart, after the fashion of the gnomes, living in Hisalome after the days of Turambar, but before the fall of Gondolin, and he trod Olore Male, the path of dreams. Is he then a child, one of the children of the fathers of men, who found Kor and remain with the Eldar forever? The Cottage of Lost Play, 1:19-20. The opening passage agrees in almost all essentials with the ultimate form of the story. Thus there go back to the beginning of the tradition, or at least to its earliest extant form, the departure of Húrin to the Battle of Unnumbered Tears at the summons of the Noldor, while his wife Mavwin equals Morwen, and young son Turin remain behind. The great stand of Húrin's men and Húrin's capture by Morgoth, the reason for Húrin's torture, Morgoth's wish to learn the whereabouts of Turgon, and the mode of it, and Morgoth's curse. The birth of Nienor shortly after the great battle. That men were shut in Hisalome, or Hithlum, the gnomish form, which here first appears, equated with Dor Lomin, page 71, after the Battle of Unnumbered Tears, is stated in The Coming of the Elves, 1:118, and in the last of the outlines for Gilfanan's Tale, 1:241. Later on, this was transformed into the confinement of the treacherous Easterling men in Hithlum, the Silmarillion, page 195, and their ill-treatment of the survivors of the House of Hodor became an essential element in the story of Turin's childhood. But in the tale of Turambar, the idea is already present that the strange men who dwelt nigh knew not the dignity of the Lady Mavwin. End of side 4. Change side selector switch. This book is continued on the next cassette. Side 5, The Book of Lost Tales, Part 2, by J.R.R. Tolkien, continuing on page 120. It is not, in fact, clear where Urin dwelt. It is said here that after the battle, Mavwin got her in tears into the land of Hithlum or Dor Lomin, where all men must now dwell, which can only mean that she went there on account of Melkor's command from wherever she had dwelt with Urin before. On the other hand, a little later in the tale, page 73, and in apparent contradiction to this, Marwyn would not accept the invitation of Tinwellen to come to Artanor, partly because, it is suggested, she clung to that dwelling that Urin had set her in ere he went to the great war. In the later story, Morwen resolved to send Turin away from fear that he would be enslaved by the Easterlings, Narn, page 70, whereas here all that is said is that Mavwin knew not in her distress how to foster both him and his sister, which presumably reflects her poverty. This in turn reflects a further difference, namely that here Nienore was born before Turin's departure, but see page 131. In the later legend, he and his companions left Dor Lomin in the autumn of the Year of Lamentation, and Nienor was born early in the following year. Thus he had never seen her even as an infant. An important underlying difference is the absence in the tale of the motive that Húrin had himself visited Gondolin, a fact known to Morgoth and the reason for his being taken alive, the Silmarillion, pages 158-9, 196-7. This element in the story arose much later, when the founding of Gondolin was set far back and long before the Battle of Unnumbered Tears. 2. Turin in Artanor, pages 72-6. From the original story of Turin's journey, the two old men who accompanied him, one of whom returned to Mavwin while the older remained with Turin, were never lost. And the cry of Turin as they set out reappears in the Narn, page 73, Morwen, Morwen, when shall I see you again? Beleg was present from the beginning, as was the meaning of his name. He was called Beleg, for he was of great stature. See 1254, entry Haloisi Velike, and the appendix to The Silmarillion, entry Beleg. And he plays the same role in the old story, rescuing the travelers starving in the forest and taking them to the king. In the later versions, there is no trace of the remarkable message sent by Tinwellen to Maugwin, and indeed his curiously candid explanation that he held aloof from the Battle of Unnumbered Tears because in his wisdom he foresaw that Artenor could become a refuge if disaster befell, is hardly in keeping with his character as afterwards conceived. There were, of course, quite other reasons for his conduct, The Silmarillion, page 189. On the other hand, Maugwin's motives for not herself leaving Githlum remained unchanged. See the passage in Manon, page 70, where the word almsguest is an echo of the old tale. But the statement is puzzling that Maugwin might, when the Anori was grown, have put aside her pride and passed over the mountains had they not become impassable, clearly suggesting that she never left Githlum. Perhaps the meaning is, however, that she might have made the journey earlier, while Turin was still in Artenor, than she in fact did, when for a time the ways became easier, but Turin had gone. The character of Turin as a boy reappears in every stroke of the description in the Narn, page 77. It seemed that fortune was unfriendly to him, so that often what he designed went awry, and what he desired he did not gain. Neither did he win friendship easily, for he was not merry and laughed seldom, and a shadow lay on his youth. It is a notable point that is added in the tale, at no time did he give much heed to words that were spoken to him. And the ending of all word between Turin and his mother comes about in the same way, increased guard on the mountains, Narn, page 78. While the story of Turin and Syros, as told in the Silmarillion and in far more detail in the Narn, goes back in essentials to the tale of Turambar, there are some notable differences, the chief being that as the story was first told, Turin's tormentor was slain outright by the thrown drinking cup. The later complications of Syros' treacherous assault on Turin the following day and his chase to the death, of the trial of Turin in his absence for this deed, and of the testimony of Nelos, this last only in the Narn, are entirely absent, necessarily. Nor does Mablung appear. Indeed, it seems clear that Mablung first emerged at the end of the tale of Tinuviel, see page 59. Some details survived, as the comb which Orgoth Syros offered tauntingly to Turin, Narn, page 80. While others were changed or neglected, as it was the anniversary of Turin's departure from his home, though the figure of 12 years agrees with the later story, and that the king was present in the hall, contrast Narn, page 79. But the taunt that roused Turin to murderous rage remained essentially the same, in that it touched on his mother, and the story was never changed that Turin came into the hall tousled and roughly clad, and that he was mocked for this by his enemy. Orgoth is not greatly distinct from Syros, if less developed. He was in the king's favor, proud and jealous of Turin. In the later story, he was a Nondurin elf, while here he is an Ilkurin with some gnomish blood, for gnomes in Artenor, see page 65. But doubtless some peculiarity in his origin was part of the tradition. In the old story, he is explicitly a fop and a fool, and he is not given the motives of hatred for Turin that are ascribed to him in the Narn, page 77. Though far simpler in narrative, the essential element of Turin's ignorance of his pardon was present from the outset. The tale provides an explanation, not found later, of why Turin did not, on leaving Artenor, return to Githlum. Compare the Narn, page 87, to Dor Lomin he did not dare, for he was closely beset, and one man alone could not hope at that time, as he thought, to come through the passes of the Mountains of Shadow. Turin's prowess against the orcs during his sojourn in Artenor is given a more central or indeed unique importance in the tale. He held the wrath of Melko from them for many years, especially as Beleg, his companion in arms in the later versions, is not here mentioned, and in this passage the power of the queen to withstand invasion of the kingdom seems again, see page 63, less than it afterwards became. 3. Turin and Beleg, pages 76 to 81. That part of the Turin saga, following on his days in Artenor, Doriath, underwent a large development later, Turin among the outlaws.
and indeed my father never brought this part of the story to finality. In the oldest version, there is a much more rapid development of the plot. Beleg joins Turin's band, and the destruction of the band and capture of Turin by the orcs follows, in terms of the narrative, almost immediately. There is no mention of outlaws, but only of wild spirits. No long search for Turin by Beleg, no capture and maltreatment of Beleg by the band, and no betrayal of the camp by a traitor, the part ultimately taken by Mime the dwarf. Beleg, indeed, as already noticed, is not said to have been Turin's companion in the earlier time, before the slaying of Orgoth, and they only take up together after Turin's self-imposed exile. Beleg is called Arnoldo, page 78, and if this single reference is to be given full weight, and there seems no reason not to, it is explicit in the tale of Tinuviel that there were Noldali in Artenor, and Orgoth had gnomish blood. Then it is to be observed that Beleg, as originally conceived, was an elf of Kor. He is not here marked out as a great bowman, neither his name Cuthalion, Strongbow, nor his great bow Belthrunding appear. He is described at his first appearance, page 73, as a wood ranger, a huntsman of the secret elves, but not as the chief of the march wardens of the realm. But from the capture of Turin to the death of Beleg, the old tale was scarcely changed afterwards in any really important respect, though altered in many details, such as Beleg's shooting of the wolf sentinels silently in the darkness in the later story, and the flash of lightning that illuminated Beleg's face. But the blue shining lamps of the Noldor appear again in much later writings. One was borne by the elves Gelmir and Arminas, who guided Tuor through the gate of the Noldor on his journey to the sea. The Unfinished Tales, pages 22, 51, note 2. In my father's painting, probably dating from 1927 or 1928, of the meeting between Beleg and Flinding in Taur Nufuin, reproduced in Pictures by J.R.R. Tolkien, number 37, Flinding's lamp is seen beside him. The plot of the old story is very precisely contrived in such details as the reason for the carrying of Turin still sleeping out of the orc camp, and for Beleg's using his sword, rather than a knife, to cut Turin's bonds. Perhaps also in the crushing of Beleg by Turin, so that he was winded and could not speak his name before Turin gave him his death blow. The story of Turin's madness after the slaying of Beleg, the guidance of Gwyndor, and the release of Turin's tears at Aethul Ivrin is here in embryo. Of the peculiar nature of Beleg's sword, there is no suggestion. 4. Turin among the Rodothlim, Turin and Glorin, pages 81 to 88. In this passage is found, so far as written record goes, for it is to be remembered that a wholly erased text underlies the manuscript, the origin of Nargothrond, as yet unnamed. Among many remarkable features, the chief is perhaps that Orodreth was there before Felagund, lord of Cain, with whom in the later legend Nargothrond was identified as its founder and deviser. In the Silmarillion, Orodreth was one of Finrod Felagund's brothers, the sons of Finarfin, to whom Felagund gave the command of Minas Tirith on Tol Sirion after the making of Nargothrond, page 120, and Orodreth became king of Nargothrond after Felagund's death. In the tale, this cave-dwelling of exiled Noldali is a simpler and rougher place, and, as is suggested, short-lived against the overwhelming power of Melko. But, as so often, there were many features that were never altered, even though in a crucial respect the history of Nargothrond was to be greatly modified by contact with the legend of Beren and Tinuviel. Thus the site was from the start above a stream, the later Narog, that ran down to feed the river Sirion. And as is seen later, page 96, the bank of the river on the side of the caves was higher and the hills drew close. Compare the Silmarillion, page 114, the caves under the high Faroth in its steep western shore. The policy of secrecy and refusal of open war pursued by the elves of Nargothrond was always an essential element. Compare the Silmarillion, pages 168-170, as was the overturning of that policy by the confidence and masterfulness of Turin, though in the tale there is no mention of the great bridge that he caused to be built. Footnote. The policy of secrecy and refusal of open war. From the first of these passages, it seems that when Beren came to Nargothrond, the secret policy was already pursued under Felagund. But from the second, it seems that it came into being from the potent rhetoric of Kurufin after Baron went there. End of footnote. Here, however, the fall of the redoubt is perhaps more emphatically attributed to Turin. His coming there seen more simply as a curse, and the disaster as more inevitably proceeding from his unwisdom. At least in the fragments of this part of the Narn, pages 155-7, Turin's case against Gwyndor, who argued for the continuation of secrecy, is seemingly not without substance, despite the outcome. But the essential story is the same. Turin's policy revealed Norgothrond to Morgoth, who came against it with overwhelming strength and destroyed it. In relation to the earliest version, the roles of Finding, Gwyndor, Thylivren, Finduilas, and Orodreth were to undergo a remarkable set of transferences. Footnote. In the Silmarillion, she is named Finduilas, and the name Thylivren, which is the gleam of the sun on the pools of Ivrin, was given to her by Gwyndor, pages 209-10. End of footnote. In the old tale, Finding had been of the Hrodothlim before his capture and imprisonment in Angband, just as afterwards Gwyndor came from Nargothrond. But with a great development in his story, see the Silmarillion, pages 188, 191-2, and on his return was so changed as to be scarcely recognizable. I pass over such enduring minor features as the taking of Turin and Finding, Gwyndor, prisoner on their coming to the caves. The beautiful Thylivren is already present, and her unrequited love for Turin, but the complication of her former relation with Gwyndor is quite absent, and she is not the daughter of Orodreth, the king, but of one Gullweg, who was to disappear utterly. Finding is not shown as opposed to Turin's policies, and in the final battle he aids Turin in bearing Orodreth out of the fight. Orodreth dies, after being carried back to the caves, reproaching Turin for what he has brought to pass, as does Gwyndor dying in the Silmarillion, page 213, with the added bitterness of his relation with Finduilas. But Thylivren's father Gullweg is slain in the battle, as is Finduilas' father Orodreth in the Silmarillion. Thus, in the evolution of the legend, Orodreth took over the role of Gullweg, while Gwyndor took over in part the role of Orodreth. As I have noticed earlier, there is no mention in the tale of any peculiarity attaching to Beleg's sword, and though the black sword is already present, it was made for Turin on the orders of Orodreth, and its blackness and its shining, pale edges were of its first making. See the Silmarillion, pages 209-10. Its power of speech, it is said that at times it spake dark words to him, remained afterwards in its dreadful words to Turin before his death, Narn, page 145. A motive that appears already in the tale, page 112. And Turin's name derived from the sword, here Mormogli, Mormachil, later Mormegil, was already devised. But of Turin's disguising of his true name in Nargothrond, there is no suggestion. Indeed, it is explicitly stated that he said who he was. Of Gelmir and Arminos, and the warning they brought to Nargothrond from Ulmo, Narn, pages 159-62, the germ can perhaps be seen in the whispers in the stream at eve, which undoubtedly implies messages from Ulmo, see page 77. The dragon Glorund is named in The Lengthening Spell in the Tale of Tinuvial, pages 1946. But the actual name was only introduced in the course of the writing of the Tale of Turambar, see note 11. There is no suggestion that he had played any previous part in the history, or indeed that he was the first of his kind, the father of dragons, with a long record of evil already before the sack of Nargothrond. Of great interest is the passage in which the nature of the dragons of Melko is defined, their evil wisdom, their love of lies and gold, which they may not use or enjoy, and the knowledge of tongues that men say would come from eating a dragon's heart. With evident reference to the legend in the Norse Edda of Sigurd Fafnisbane, who was unable to understand, to his own great profit, the speech of birds when he ate the heart of the dragon Fafnir, roasting it on a spit. The story of the sack of Nargothrond is somewhat differently treated in the old story, although the essentials were to remain of the driving away of Thylivren Finduilas among the captives and of the powerlessness of Turin to aid her being spellbound by the dragon. Minor differences, such as the later arrival of Glorund on the scene, In the Silmarillion, Turin only came back to Nargothrond after Glaurung had entered the caves and the sack was well nigh achieved, and minor agreements, such as the denial of the plunder to the orcs, may here be passed over. Most interesting is the account of Turin's words with the dragon. Here the whole issue of Turin's escaping or not escaping his doom is introduced. And it is significant that he takes the name Turambar at this juncture, whereas in the later legend he takes it when he joins the woodmen in Brethil, and less is made of it. The old version is far less powerfully and concisely expressed, and the dragon's words are less subtle and ingeniously untrue. Here, too, the moral is very explicitly pointed, that Turin should not have abandoned Faelivrin in danger that he himself could see. Does this not suggest that even under the dragon's spell as he was, there was a weakness, a blindness, see page 83, in Turin, which the dragon touched? As the story is told in the Silmarillion, the moral would seem uncalled for. Turin was opposed by an adversary too powerful for his mind and will. There is here a remarkable passage in which suicide is declared a sin, depriving such a one of all hope that ever his spirit would be freed from the dark glooms of Mondos or stray into the pleasant paths of Valinor. This seems to go with the perplexing passage in the tale of the coming of the Valar and the building of Valinor concerning the fates of men, see page 60. Finally, it is strange that in the old story, the gold and treasure was carried out from the caves by the orcs and remained there. It lay by the caves above the stream, and the dragon most uncharacteristically slept before it in the open. In the Silmarillion, Glaurung gathered all the hoard and riches of Felagund and heaped them and lay upon them in the innermost hall. 5. Turin's Return to Hithlum, pages 88 to 91. In this passage, the case is much as in previous parts of the tale. The large structure of the story was not greatly changed afterwards, but there are many important differences nonetheless. In the tale of Turambar, it is clear that the house of Mavwin was not imagined as standing near to the hills or mountains that formed the barrier between Hithlum and the lands beyond. Turin was told that never did orcs come hither deep into the land of Hisalome. In contrast to the Narn, page 68, where Húrin's house stood in the southeast of Dorlúmin, and the mountains were near. Then Lalaith indeed came down from a spring under the shadow of Amon Darthir, over whose shoulder there was a steep path. The removal of Mavwin from one house to another in Hithlum, visited in turn by Turin as he sought for her, was afterwards rejected to the improvement of the story. Here Turin comes back to his old home in the late summer, whereas in the Silmarillion, the fall of Nargothrond took place in the late autumn. The leaves fell from the trees in a great wind as they went, for the autumn was passing to a dire winter, page 213. And Turin came to Dorlúmin in the fell winter, page 215. The names Broda and Eirin, A-I-R-I-N, later spelled A-E-R-I-N, remain. But Broda is here the lord of the land, and Eirin plays a more important part in the scene in the hall, dealing justice with vigor and wisdom than she does later. It is not said here that she had been married by force, though her life with Broda is declared to have been very evil. But of course the situation in the later narratives is far more clear-cut. The men of Hithlum were Easterlings, incomers hostile to the elves and the remnant of the house of Hador, whereas in the early story no differentiation is made among them, and indeed Broda was a man whom Mavwin trusted. The motive of Broda's ill-treatment of Mavwin is already present, but only to the extent that he embezzled her goods after her departure. In the Narn, it seems from Eirin's words to Turin, page 107, that the oppression of Morwen by Broda and others was the cause of her going at last to Doriath. In the brief account in the Silmarillion, page 215, it is not indeed made explicit that Broda in particular deserved Turin's hatred. Turin's conduct in the hall is in the tale essentially simpler. The true story has been told to him by a passer-by. He enters to exact vengeance on Broda for thieving Mavwin's goods, and he does so with dispatch. As told in the Narn, where Turin's eyes are only finally opened to the deception that has been practiced upon him by the words of Eirin, who is present in the hall, his rage is more passionate, crazed, and bitter, and indeed more comprehensible. And the moral observation that Turin's deed was violent and unlawful is not made. The story of Irene's judgment on these doings, made in order to save Turin, was afterwards removed, and Turin's solitary departure was expanded with the addition also of the firing of Broda's Hall by Irene, Narn, page 109. Some details survived all the changes. In the Narn, Turin still seizes Broda by the hair, and just as in the tale, his rage suddenly expired after the deed of violence. His wrath was grown cold. So in the Narn, the fire of his rage was as ashes. It may be noticed here that while in the old story, Turin does not rename himself so often, his tendency to do so is already present. The story of how Turin came among the woodmen and delivered them from orcs is not found in the tale of Turambar, nor is there any mention of the mound of Finduilas near the crossings of Teiglin, nor any account of her fate. 6. The return of Gumlin to Hithlum and the departure of Mavwin and Nienori to Artenor, pages 91-3. In the later story, the elder of Turin's guardians, Gumlin in the tale, Grithnir in the Narn, plays no part after his bringing Turin to Doriath. It is only said that he stayed there till he died, Narn, page 74. And Morwen had no tidings out of Doriath before leaving her home. Indeed, she only learnt that Turin had left Thingol's realm when she got there, the Silmarillion, page 211. Compare Irin's words in the Narn, page 107, she looked to find her son there awaiting her. This whole section of the tale does no more than explain with what my father doubtless felt, since he afterwards rejected it almost in its entirety, to be unnecessary complication why Mavwin went to Tin Welland. I think it is clear, however, that the difference between the versions here depends on the different views of Marwyn's, Morwen's, condition in Hithlum. In the old story, she is not suffering hardship and oppression. She trusts Broda to the extent of entrusting not only her goods to him, but even her daughter, and is said indeed to have peace and honor among the men of those regions. The chieftains speak of the love they bear her. A motive for her departure is found in the coming of Gumlin and the news he brings of Turin's flight from the lands of Tin Welland. In the later story, on the other hand, Broda's character as tyrant and oppressor is extended, and it is Morwen's very plight at his hands that leads her to depart. The news that came to Turin in Doriath that Morwen's plight was eased, Narn, page 77, compare the Silmarillion, page 199, is probably a survival from the old story. Nothing is said in the later narratives to explain how this came about and ceased. In either case, her motive for leaving is coupled with the fact of the increased safety of the lands. But whereas in the later story the reason for this was the prowess of the black sword of Nargothrond, in the tale it was the great and terrible project of Melko that was afoot, the assault on the caves of the Rodothlim, see note 18. It is curious that in this passage, Irin and Broda are introduced as if for the first time. It is perhaps significant that the part of the tale extending from the dragon's words, "Hearken to me, O son of Urin," on page 87, to "fell to his knees before Tin Welland," on page 92, was written in a separate part of the manuscript book. Possibly this replaced an earlier text in which Broda and Irin did not appear. But many such questions arise from the earliest manuscripts, and few can now be certainly unraveled. 7. Mavwin and Nienori in Artenor and their meeting with Glorimb, pages 93-9. The next essential step in the development of the plot, the learning by Mavwin Morwin of Turin's sojourn in Nargothrond, is more neatly and naturally handled in the Silmarillion, page 217, and the Narn, page 112, where news is brought to Thingol by fugitives from the sack, in contrast to the tale of Turambar, where Mavwin and Nienori only learn of the destruction of the elves of the caves from a band of Noldali while themselves wandering aimlessly in the forest. It is odd that these Noldali did not name Turin by his name, but only as the Mormacil. It seems that they did not know who he was, but they knew enough of his history to make his identity plain to Mavwin. As noted above, Turin declared his name and lineage to the elves of the caves. In the later narrative, on the other hand, Turin did conceal it in Nargothrond, calling himself Agarwain. But all those who brought news of the fall to Doriath declared that it was known to many in Nargothrond ere the end that the Mormegiel was none other than Turin, son of Hurin of Dor Lomin. As often, unneeded complication in the early story was afterwards cleared away. Thus the elaborate argumentation needed to get Tinwellant's warriors and Morwen and Nienori on the road together is gone from the Silmarillion and the Narn. In the tale, the ladies and the elvish warriors all set off together with the full intention that the former shall watch developments from a high place, afterwards Amon Ethir, the Hill of Spies. In the later story, Morwen simply rides off, and the party of elves, led by Mablung, follows after her, with Nienor among them in disguise. Particularly notable is the passage in the tale in which Morwen holds out the great gold hoard of the Rodolphlim as a bait to Tinwellant. And Tinwellant unashamedly admits that, as a wild elf of the woods, it is this, not any hope of aiding Turin, that moves him to send out a party. The majesty, power, and pride of Thingol rose with the development of the conception of the grey elves of Beleriand. As I have said earlier, page 63, in the beginning, Tinwellant's dwelling was not a subterranean city full of marvels, but a rugged cave. And here he is seen planning a foray to augment his slender wealth in precious things, a far cry from the description of his vast treasury in the Narn, page 76. Now Thingol had in Menegroth deep armories filled with great wealth of weapons, metal wrought like fisher's mail and shining like water in the moon, swords and axes, shields and helms wrought by Telchar himself or by his master Gomil Zirak the Old, or by elven rites more skillful still. For some things he had received in gift that came out of Valinor and were wrought by Feanor in his mastery, than whom no craftsman was greater in all the days of the world. Great as are the differences from the later legend in the encounter with the dragon, the stinking vapors raised by his lying in the river as the cause of the miscarriage of the plan, the maddened flight of the horses, and the enspelling of Nienor so that all memory of her past was lost, are already present. Most striking, perhaps, of the many differences is the fact that Morwen was present at the conversation with Glorund, and of these speeches there is no echo in the Narn, pages 118 to 19, save that Nienor's naming of Turin as the object of their quest revealed her identity to the dragon. This is explicit in the Narn, and may probably be surmised from the tale. The peculiar tone of Glaurung in the later narrative, sneering and curt, knowing and self-possessed, and unfathomably wicked, can be detected already in the words of Glorund, but as he evolved, he gained immeasurably in dread by becoming more laconic. The chief difference of structure lies in the total absence of the Mablung element from the tale, nor is there any foreshadowing of it. There is no suggestion of an exploration of the sacked dwellings in the dragon's absence. Indeed, he does not, as it appears, go any distance from them. The purpose of the expedition from Artenor was expressly warlike, a strong party against the foe Eloke. They prepared them for battle. Since Tinwellant had hopes of laying hands on the treasure, whereas afterwards it became purely a scouting foray. For Thingol desired greatly to know more of the fate of Nargothrond, Narn, page 113. A curious point is that though Morwen and Nienori were to be stationed on the tree-covered high place that was afterward called the Hill of Spies, and where they were in fact so stationed in the Silmarillion and the Narn, it seems that in the old story they never got there, but were ensnared by Glorund where he lay in or not far from the river. Thus the high place had in the event almost no significance in the tale. 8. Turambar and Niniel, pages 99-102. In the later legend, Nienor was found by Mablung after her enspelling by Glaurung, and with three companions he led her back towards the borders of Doriath. The chase after Nienor by the band of orcs, Narn, page 120, is present in the tale, but it does not have its later narrative function of leading to Nienor's flight and loss by Mablung and the other elves who do not appear. Rather, it leads directly to her rescue by Turambar, now dwelling among the woodmen. In the Narn, page 122, the woodmen of Brethil did indeed come past the spot where they found her on their return from a foray against orcs. But the circumstances of her finding are altogether different, most especially since there is in the tale no mention of the Hauv en Elith, the mound of Finduilas. An interesting detail concerns Nienor's response to Turambar's naming her Ninyal. In the Silmarillion and the Narn, she shook her head but said Ninyal. In the present text, she said, not Ninyal, not Ninyal. One has the impression that in the old story, what impressed her darkened mind was only the resemblance of Ninyal to her own forgotten name, Nienori, and of Turambar to Turin. Whereas in the later, she both denied and in some way accepted the name Ninyal. An original element in the legend is the woodman's bringing of Ninyal to a place, Silver Bowl, where there was a great waterfall, afterwards Dimrost, the rainy stair, where the stream of Celebros fell towards Teiglin. And these falls were near to the dwellings of the woodmen. But the place where they found Ninyal was much further off in the forest, several days' journey, than were the crossings of Teiglin from Dimrost. When she came there, she was filled with dread, a foreboding of what was to happen there afterwards. And this is the origin of her shuddering fit in the later narratives, from which the place was renamed Nen Girith, the Shuddering Water. See Narn, page 149, note 24. The utter darkness imposed on Ninyal's mind by the dragon's spell is less emphasized in the tale, and there is no suggestion that she needed to relearn her very language. But it is interesting to observe the recurrence in a changed context of the simile of one that seeks for something mislaid. In the Narn, page 123, Ninyal is said to have taken great delight in the relearning of words, as one that finds again treasures great and small that were mislaid. The lame man here called Tamar and his vain love of Ninyal already appear. Unlike his later counterpart, Brandir, he was not the chief of the woodmen, but he was the son of the chief. He was also half-elven. Most extraordinary is the statement that the wife of Bethos, the chieftain and mother of Tamar, was an elf, a woman of the Noldali. This is mentioned in passing, as if the great significance and rarity of the union of elf and mortal had not yet emerged. But in a name list associated with the tale of the fall of Gondolin, Earendel is said to be the only being that is half of the kindred of the Eldalie and half of men, page 215. Footnote. In a later rewriting of a passage in that tale, page 164 and note 22, it is said of Tuor and Idril of Gondolin, thus was first wed a child of men with a daughter of Elfinesse, nor was Tuor the last. End of footnote. The initial reluctance of Ninyal to receive Turambar's suit is given no explanation in the tale. The implication must be that some instinct, some subconscious appreciation of the truth, held her back. In the Silmarillion, page 220, for that time she delayed in spite of her love. For Brandir foreboded he knew not what, and sought to restrain her, rather for her sake than his own or rivalry with Turambar. And he revealed to her that Turambar was Turin, son of Hurin, and though she knew not the name, a shadow fell upon her mind. In the final version, as in the oldest, the woodman knew who Turambar was. My father's scribbled directions for the alteration of the story, cited in note 23, make Turambar never tell new folk of his lineage, are puzzling, for since Ninyal had lost all memory of her past, she would not know the names Turin, son of Hurin, even if it were told to her that Turambar was he. It is, however, possible that when my father wrote this, he imagined Ninyal's lost knowledge of herself and her family as being nearer the surface of her mind, and capable of being brought back by hearing the name. In contrast to the later story, where she did not consciously recognize the name of Turin, even when Brandir told it to her. Clearly the question mark against the reference in the text of the tale to Turambar's speaking to Ninyal of his father and mother and the sister he had not seen, and Ninyal's distress at his words, see note 24, depends on the same train of thought. The statement here that Turambar had never seen his sister is at variance with what is said earlier in the tale, that he did not leave Hithlum until after Nienori's birth, page 71. But my father was uncertain on this point, as is clearly seen from the succession of readings changed back and forth between the two ideas given in note 15. 9. The Slaying of Glorund, pages 103-8. In this section I follow the narrative of the tale as far as Turin's swoon when the dying dragon opened his eyes and looked at him. Here the later story runs very close to the old, but there are many interesting differences. In the tale, Glorund is said to have had bands of both orcs and Noldorli subject to him, but only the orcs remained afterwards. Compare the Narn, page 125. Now the power and malice of Glaurung grew apace, and he waxed fat. Compare the Foaloke waxed fat. And he gathered orcs to him and ruled as a dragon king, and all the realm of Nargothrond that had been was laid under him. The mention in the tale that Tinwellen's people were grievously harried by Glorin's bands suggests once again that the magic of the queen was no very substantial protection, while the statement that at length there came some orcs nigh even to those woods and glades that were beloved of Turambar and his folk seems at variance with Turambar's saying to Niniel earlier that we are hard put to it to fend those evil ones from our homes, page 100. There is no mention here of Turambar's pledge to Niniel that he would go to battle only if the homes of the woodmen were assailed, Narn, pages 125-6, and there is no figure corresponding to Dorlas of the later versions. Tamar's character, briefly described, page 106, is in accord so far as it goes with what is later told of Brandir, but the relationship of Brandir to Niniel, who called him her brother, Narn, page 124, had not emerged. The happiness and prosperity of the woodmen under Turambar's chieftainship is much more strongly emphasized in the tale. Afterwards, he was not indeed the chieftain, at least not in name. And it leads, in fact, to Glorin's greed as a motive for his assault on them. The topographical indications in this passage, important to the narrative, are readily enough accommodated to the later accounts, with one major exception. It is clear that in the old story, the stream of the waterfall that fell down to the Silver Bowl was the same as that which ran through the gorge where Turambar slew Glorund. Here flowed that same stream that further down wound past the dragon's lair. Lair equals the place where he was lying, in a deep bed cloven deep into the earth, page 105. Thus Turambar and his companions, as he said, will go down the rocks to the foot of the fall, and so, gaining the path of the stream, perchance we may come as nigh to the drake as may be, Ibid. In the final story, on the other hand, the falling stream, Celebros, was a tributary of Teglin. Compare the Narn, page 127. Now the river Teglin flowed down from arid Wethrin swift as Narog, but at first between low shores, until after the crossings, gathering power from other streams, it clove a way through the feet of the highlands upon which stood the forest of Brethil. Thereafter it ran in deep ravines, whose great sides were like walls of rock, but pent at the bottom the waters flowed with great force and noise. And right in the path of Glaurung there lay now one of these gorges, by no means the deepest, but the narrowest, just north of the inflow of Celebros. The pleasant place, a green sward where grew a wealth of flowers, survived. Compare the Narn, page 123, there was a wide greensward at the head of the falls, and birches grew about it. So also did the Silver Bowl, though the name was lost. The stream, Celebros, went over a lip of worn stone, and fell down by many foaming steps into a rocky bowl far below. Narn, Ibid, compare the tale, page 105, it fell over a great fall where the water-worn rock jutted smooth and grey from amid the grass. The little hill, or knoll, islanded among the trees, from which Turambar and his companions looked out, is not so described in the Narn, but the picture of a high place and lookout near the head of the falls remain, as may be seen from the statement in the Narn, page 123, that from Nengirith there was a wide view towards the ravines of Teglin. Later, Narn, page 128, it is said that it was Turambar's intention to ride to the high fall of Nengirith, whence he could look far across the lands. It seems certain, then, that the old image never faded, and was only a little changed. While in both old and late accounts a great concourse of the people follow Turambar to the head of the falls against his bidding, in the late his motive for commanding them not to come is explicit. They are to remain in their homes and prepare for flight. Here, on the other hand, Niniel rides with Turambar to the head of Silver Bowl and says farewell to him there, but a detail of the old story survives. Turambar's words to Niniel, nor thou nor I die this day, nor yet tomorrow, by the evil of the dragon, or by the foeman's swords, are closely paralleled by his words to her in the Narn, page 129, neither you nor I shall be slain by this dragon, nor by any foe of the north. And in the one account, Ninyal quelled her weeping and was very still, while in the other she ceased to weep and fell silent. The situation is generally simpler in the tale, in that the woodmen are scarcely characterized. Tamar is not, as Brondir, the titular head of the people, and this motive for bitterness against Turambar is absent, nor is there a Dorlas to insult him or a Hunthor to rebuke Dorlas. Tamar is, however, present with Ninyal at the same point in the story, having girded himself with a sword, and many scoffed at him for that, just as it is afterwards said of Brondir that he had seldom done so before. Narn, page 132. Turambar here set out from the head of the falls with six companions, all of whom proved in the end faint-hearted, whereas later he had only two, Dorlas and Hunthor remained staunch, though killed by a falling stone in the gorge. But the result is the same, in that Turambar must climb the further cliff of the gorge alone. Here the dragon remained where he lay near the brink of the cliff all night, and only moved with the dawn, so that his death and the events that immediately followed it took place by daylight. But in other respects, the killing of the dragon remained, even in many details, much as it was originally written, more especially if comparison is made with the Narn, page 134, where there reappears the need for Turambar and his companions, to move from their first station in order to come up directly under the belly of the beast. This is passed over in the Silmarillion. Two notable points in this section remain to be mentioned. Both are afterthoughts penciled into the manuscript. In the one, we meet for the first time Mim the Dwarf as the captain of Glorin's guard over his treasure during his absence. A strange choice for the post, one would think. On this matter, see page 137 below. In the other, it is said that Ninyal conceived a child by Turambar, which, remarkably enough, is not said in the text as originally written. On this, see page 135. 10. The Deaths of Turin and Nienori, pages 108 to 12. In the conclusion of the story, the structure remained the same from the old tale to the Narn. The moonlight, the tending of Turambar's burnt hand, the cry of Ninyal that stirred the dragon to his final malice, the accusation by the dragon that Turambar was a stabber of foes unseen, Turambar's naming Tamar Brondir Clubfoot, and sending him to consort with the dragon in death, the sudden withering of the leaves at the place of Nienor's leap as if it were already the end of autumn, the invocation of Nienor to the waters and of Turambar to his sword, the raising of Turin's mound, and the inscription in strange signs upon it. Many other features could be added, but there are also many differences. Here I refer only to some of the most important. Mabluung being absent from the old story, it is only Turambar's intuition, being free now of blindness, the blindness that Melko wove of old, page 83, that informs him that Tamar was telling the truth. Footnote. Compare his words to Mabluung in the Narn, page 144. For see, I am blind, did you not know? Blind, blind, groping since childhood in a dark mist of Morgoth. End of footnote. The slaying of Glaurung and all its aftermath is in the late story compassed in the course of a single night and the morning of the next day, whereas in the tale it is spread over two nights, the intervening day and the morning of the second. Turambar is carried back to the people on the hilltop by the three deserters who had left him in the ravine, whereas in the late story he comes himself. Of the slaying of Dorlas by Brandir, there is no trace in the tale, and the taking of a sword by Tamar has no issue. Particularly interesting is the result of the changing of the place where Turin and Nienori died. In the tale, there is only one river, and Ninyal follows the stream up through the woods and casts herself over the falls of Silver Bowl, in the place afterwards called Nen-Girith. And here, too, in the glade above the falls, Turambar slew himself. In the developed story, her death leap was into the ravine of Teglin at Kobed en Arras, the deer's leap, near the spot where Turambar lay beside Glaurung, and here Turambar's death took place also. Thus Ninyal's sense of dread when she first came to Silver Bowl with the woodman who rescued her, page 101, foreboded her own death in that place. But in the changed story, there is less reason for a foreknowledge of evil to come upon her there. But while the place was changed, the withering of the leaves remained, and the awe of the scene of their deaths, so that none would go to Kovid and Aras after, as they would not set foot on the grass above Silver Bowl. The most remarkable feature of the earliest version of the story of Turambar and Ninyal is surely that as my father first wrote it, he did not say that she had conceived a child by him, note 25. And thus there is nothing in the old story corresponding to Glaurung's words to her of the worst of all his deeds thou shalt feel in thyself, Narn, page 138. The fact that above all accounts for Nienor's utter horror and despair was added to the tale later. In concluding this long analysis of the tale of Turambar proper, the absence of place names in the later part of it may be remarked. The dwelling of the Rodolphlin is not named, nor the river that flowed past it. No name is given to the forest where the woodmen dwelt, to their village, or even to the stream of such central importance at the end of the story. Contrast Nargothrond, Narog, Tumhalad, Amon Ethir, Brethil, Amon Obil, Efel Brondir, Teglin, Celebros of the later narratives. Section 2. The Further Narrative of Eltos After the Death of Turin. My father struck out the greater part of this continuation, allowing it to stand only as far as the words, by reason of her great unhappiness, on page 113, see note 31. From the brief passage that was retained, it is seen that the story of Morwen's coming to the stone on Turin's mound goes back to the beginning, though in the later story she met Hurin there, the Silmarillion, page 229. The rejected part continues as follows. Yet it is said also that when the doom of his folk was utterly fulfilled, then was Urin released by Melko, and bowed with age he fared back into the better lands. There did he gather some few to him, and they went and found the caverns of the Rothwarren, earlier form for Rodolphlim, see page 119, empty, and none guarded them. And a mighty treasury lay there still, for none had found it, in that the terror of the drake lived longer than he, and none had ventured thither again. But Uren let bear the gold even before Linwe, that is, Tinwelland, and, casting it before his feet, bade him bitterly to take his vile reward, naming him a craven by whose faint heart had much evil fallen to his house that might never have been. And in this began a new estrangement between elves and men, for Linwe was wroth at Urin's words and bid him begone, for said he, long did I foster Turin thy son and forgave him the evil of his deeds, and afterward thy wife I succored, giving way against my counsel to her wild desires. Yet what is it to me, and wherefore dost thou, O son of the uncouth race of men, endure to upbraid a king of the Eldali, eh, whose life began in Polisor ages uncounted before men were born? And then Urin would have gone, but his men were not willing to leave the gold there, and a dissension arose between them and the elves, and of this grew bitter blows. And Tintoglin, that is Tinwelland, might not stay them. There then was Urin's band slain in his halls, and they stained with their blood the dragon's hoard. But Urin escaped and cursed that gold with a dread curse so that none might enjoy it, and he that held any part of it found evil and death to come of it. But Linwe, hearing that curse, caused the gold to be cast into a deep pool of the river before his doors, and not for very long did any see it again, save for the Ring of Doom, he mended to the Necklace of the Dwarves. And that tale belongs not here, although therein did the evil of the worm Glorin find its last fulfillment. The last phrase is an addition to the text. The remainder of this rejected narrative concerning the final fates of Urin and Marwen and their children is essentially the same as in the replacement text given on page 115, Then Urin departed, and need not be given. Immediately following the rejected narrative, there is a short outline headed Story of the Nauglofring, or the Necklace of the Dwarves, and this also was struck through. Here there is no mention of Urin at all, but it is told that the orcs, emended from Gongs, see 1245, note 10, who guarded the treasury of Glorind, went in search of him when he did not come back to the caves, and in their absence, Tintoglin, that is Tinwelland, learning of Glorin's death, sent elves to steal the hoard of the Rothwarren, that is Rodolphin. The orcs, returning, cursed the thieves, and they cursed the gold also. Linwe, that is Tinwelland, guarded the gold, and he had a great necklace made by certain Uvanimor, Nautar or Nugla. Uvanimor have been defined in an earlier tale as monsters, giants, and ogres, see 175-236. Naugloth are dwarves, 1-236. In this necklace the Silmaril was set, but the curse of the gold was on him, and he defrauded them of part of their reward. The Naugloth plotted and got aid of men. Linwë was slain in a raid, and the gold carried away. There follows another rejected outline, headed The Necklace of the Dwarves, and this combines features of the preceding outline with features of the rejected ending of Eltar's narrative, pages 135-6. Here Úrin gathers a band of elves and men who are wild and fierce, and they go to the caves, which are lightly guarded because the Orki, that is, orcs, are abroad seeking Glorund. They carry off the treasure, and the orcs returning curse it. Úrin casts the treasure before the king and reproaches him, saying that he might have sent a greater company to the caves to secure the treasure, if not to aid Morwen in her distress. Tintoglen would not touch it, and bid Úrin hold what he had won, but Úrin would depart with bitter words. Úrin's men were not willing to leave it, and they sneaked back. There was an affray in the king's halls, and much blood was spilt on the gold. The outline concludes thus: the gongs sack Linwë's halls, and Linwë is slain, and the gold is carried far away. Beren Ermabwed falls upon them at a crossing of Sirion, and the treasure is cast into the water, and with it the Silmaril of Feanor. The Naugloth that dwell nigh dive after the gold, but only one mighty necklace of gold, and that Silmaril is on it, do they find. This becomes a mark of their king. These two outlines are partly concerned with the story of the Naugloffring, and show my father pondering that story before he wrote it. There is no need to consider these elements here. It is evident that he was in great doubt as to the further course of the story after the release of Úrin. What happened to the dragon's hoard? Was it guarded or unguarded? And if guarded, by whom? How did it come at last into Tinwellin's hands? Who cursed it, and at what point in the story? If it was Úrin and his band that seized it, were they men or elves, or both? In the final text, written on slips placed in the manuscript book and given above, pages 113-16, these questions were resolved thus. Úrin's band was at first men, then changed to elves, see note 33. The treasure was guarded by the dwarf Mim, whom Úrin slew, and it was he who cursed the gold as he died. Úrin's band became a baggage train to carry the treasure to Tinwellin in sacks and wooden boxes, and they got it to the bridge before the king's door in the heart of the forest without apparently any difficulty. In this text there is no hint of what happened to the treasure after Úrin's departure, because the tale of the Naugloffring begins at that point. Subsequent to the writing of the tale of Turambar proper, my father inserted Mim into the text at an earlier point in the story, see pages 103, 118, note 26, making him the captain of the guard appointed by Glorund to watch the treasure in his absence. But whether this was written in before or after the appearance of Mim at the end, pages 113-14, whether it represents a different idea, or is an explanation of how Mim came to be there, I cannot say. In the Silmarillion, pages 230-32, the story is wholly changed, in that the treasure remained in Nargothrond, and Húrin, after the slaying of Mim, for a far better reason than that in the early narrative, brought nothing from it to Doriath save the Necklace of the Dwarves. Of the astonishing feature of the end of Eltar's narrative, pages 115-16, of the deification of Turin Turambar and Nianori, and the refusal of the gods of death to open their doors to them, it must be said that nowhere is there any explanation given, though in much later versions of the mythology Turin Turambar appears in the last battle and smites Morgoth with his black sword. The purifying bath into which Turin and Nianori entered, called Fos Almir in the final text, was in the rejected text named Fauri. In the Tale of the Sun and Moon, it has been described, 1-187, but is there given other names, Tanyasalpe, Vaskalanuman, and Vaskalan. There remains one further scrap of text to be considered. The second of the rejected outlines given above, pages 136-7, was written in ink over a penciled outline that was not erased, and I have been able to disinter a good deal of it from beneath the later writing. The two passages have nothing to do with each other. For some reason, my father did not trouble in this case to erase earlier writing. The underlying text, so far as I can make it out, reads, Tiranne and Vainoni fall in with the evil magician Kuruki, who gives them a baneful drink. They forget their names and wander distraught in the woods. Vainoni is lost. She meets Turambar, who saves her from orcs and aids in her search for her mother. They are wed and live in happiness. Turambar becomes Lord of Rangers of the Woods and a Harrier of the Orcs. He goes to seek out the Hoholoke, which ravages his land, the treasure heap and flight of his band. He slays the Hoholoke and is wounded. Vainoni succors him, but the dragon in dying tells her all, lifting the veil Kuruki has set over them. Anguish of Turambar and Vainoni. She flees into the woods and casts herself over a waterfall. Madness of Turambar, who dwells alone. Ellipsis. Urin escapes from Angamandi and seeks Tiranne. Turambar flees from him and falls upon his sword. Ellipsis. Urin builds a cairn and... Ellipsis. Doom of Melko. Tiranne dies of grief and Urin reaches his Salome. Ellipsis. Purification of Turambar and Vainoni, who fare shining about the world, and go with the hosts of Tulkas against Melko. Detached jottings follow this, doubtless written at the same time. Urin escapes. Tiranne learns of Turin. Both wander distraught in the wood. Turin leaves Linwë, for in a quarrel he slew one of Linwë's kin accidentally. Introduce Faelivrin element into the story? Question mark. Turambar, unable to fight because of Hoholoke's eyes, sees Faelivrin depart. This can only represent some of my father's very earliest meditations on the story of Turin Turambar. That it appears in the notebook at the end of the fully written tale may seem surprising, but he clearly used these books in a rather eccentric way. The Inori is here called Vainoni, and Mavwin Tiranne. The spell of forgetfulness is here laid by a magician named Kuruki, although it is the dragon who lifts the veil that the magician set over them. Turin's two encounters with the dragon seem to have emerged from an original single one. As I have mentioned before, the tale of Turambar, like others of the lost tales, is written in ink over a wholly erased penciled text, and the extant form of the tale is such that it could only be derived from a rougher draft preceding it. But the underlying text is so completely erased that there is no clue as to what stage it had reached in the development of the legend. It may well be, I think it is extremely probable, that in this outline concerning Vainoni, Tiranne, and Kuruki, we glimpse, by an odd chance, a layer in the Turin saga older even than the erased text underlying the extant version. Section 3, Miscellaneous Matters. 1. Beren. The rejected passage given on page 71, together with the marginal note, If Beren be a gnome, as now in the story of Tinuviel, the references to Beren must be altered, note 4, is the basis for my assertion, page 52, that in the earliest, now lost form of the tale of Tinuviel, Beren was a man. I have shown, I hope, that the extant form of the tale of Turambar preceded the extant form of the tale of Tinuviel, page 69. Beren was a man, and akin to Mavwin, when the extant Turambar was written. He became a gnome in the extant Tinuviel, and this change was then written into Turambar. What the replacement passage on page 72 does is to change the relation of Egnor and Beren from kinship with Urin's wife to friendship with Urin. A correction to the typescript version of Tinuviel, page 45, is later, making the comradeship of Urin with Beren rather than with Egnor. Two further changes to the text of Turambar, consequent on the change in Beren from man to elf, are given in notes 5 and 6. It is interesting to observe that in the developed genealogy of the Silmarillion, when Beren was of course again a man, he was also again akin to Morwen, for Beren was first cousin to Morwen's father, Baragund. In the rejected passage on page 71, my father wrote against the name Egnor.